Welcome to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
So who are the celebrities behind the anti-gun march? There were many of them, and a lot of high school kids are saying now that the reason why they joined up is because their favorite celebrity was going to be a part of the march, and that celebrity is anti-gun. So we'll talk about that and what their motivation was. I'll have an interview with the author of Virtual Terror, 21st Century Cyber Warfare, on how the internet has spread terror, you might not even know it, and what you can do about it. Really looking forward to talking with him. And the cavity police. There are dental offices. Almost all states have laws that dictate certain professional groups report cases of suspected child abuse and neglect. Does that have to do with dental health, too? Well, it might. So we'll get into that one as well. Hello there, Terry here on Think America, where we reason first and then converse. I'm Terry Gilbert. This is America's Town Hall. I invite non-professional broadcasters, real people, as it were, real Americans, into the studio. So we have a town hall setting so we can talk about those thought-provoking conversation starters that drive the program. Love having today Sean. He is a kayak teacher. That's interesting. Kayak and canoe teacher, like for beginners, huh?
Yes.
Do you go down rapids like within the first five lessons or something?
Sometimes. You just try to keep them upright and not submerged.
And do I have to wear a helmet if I go with you? Because I'm apt to, you know.
Yes, always a good safety measure.
Yeah, and then I'll drown with it on too. And of course, life vests and all of that. Yeah. I did a little of that in Jackson Hole, and it was perilous for me. Long time ago I did. I was frightened, though. Maybe I should go out with you. Yeah. Nice to have you on the program.
Great to be here.
And Brian, he is a for-profit education expert. What does that mean?
That means I can do anything I need to do. That's what expert means. No, it means that I work...
Even with the show.
Even with the show. Everything I do, Terry, turns to gold.
Okay.
What that means is that I primarily work on the enrollment side for students and being their voice, and also have served in role in management for students as well.
Good, good. This is upper university level?
Yes,
or
university
high school?
Level.
University.
Yes, university.
Well, welcome
level.
To the program. Let's get right to it. We got a lot of great topics. You're fired. Let's start with that and the drain the swamp expressions. All right. Recently, the VA head got fired by President Trump, although later he said he resigned. But I believe he got fired. David Shulkin. He reportedly wasn't going to stand for another ethics scandal. The president, that is, wasn't going to stand for another ethics scandal and a mounting rebellion within another agency. In this case, it would be the Department of Veterans Affairs. Why? Because things aren't getting done at the VA. So here we've got another cabinet secretary to depart over controversies. In the VA's case, it was controversies involving expensive travel and not enacting important resolutions for VA veterans care. Here's what I'd like to get to. Trump uses this phrase, you're fired. And America is saying, drain the swamp, drain the swamp, drain the swamp. So there was some legislation that came about last year in 2017 called the Merit Act. Now, it hasn't taken off yet, but I believe Republicans should jump on this because it was introduced last year. It is the Modern Employment Reform and Transformation Act, HR, House of Representatives Act, legislation 559. And what it means, I'll start with you, Brian, is that it makes it easier to fire federal employees who think they're tenured, who might misbehave, who might be dead wood, who might say, well, I'll just go ahead and be lazy on the job because I think I'm going to be tenured anyway. And if they try to fire me, it'll be all caught up in red tape. I like this Merit Act, and I think Republicans should jump on it because I think it would be a favored piece of legislation that would help in the midterm elections and would be hard for Democrats to say, I'm not interested.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. I'd love to see a majority of the Republicans, both in the House and specifically in the U.S. Senate, get behind it. Here's the question that I would have back, Terry. Let's say they get that passed and let's say it's almost like a right to work state federal piece of legislation, right? Where you're just an at-will employee and you can be dismissed for cause. Here's the problem. Much like some other people that Trump has fired or threatened to fire, you have the Democrat Party in Washington, D.C. that says, well, we'll hire him ourselves so this guy can keep his pension. That's going on all over the place. It's happening with former hierarchy in the FBI, where you have Democrats standing around and defending people who have done a horrendous job or broken the law.
I mean, Andrew McCabe, for example, and his pension.
When he has been told he's going to be hired by the Democratic Party if that's what it takes for Schumer and Pelosi to do.
Well, what about, though, Brian, as it echoes down into the deep swamp of other federal employees, for example, the post office.
Oh.
Now, nobody wants to fire the mailman. However, if they are under the Merit Act legislation that goes through and he does his job well, it's based on merit and you can advance that way, that would be more in keeping with how private businesses look at their employees. This idea that you can just be tenured or dead wood is really a suck on the taxpayer dollar.
It is. We experience, you know, higher education specifically experiences that all the time.
Tenure all the time.
That's just whether you're at the K through 12 level or whether you're at the university level, that's a constant battle. And you talk about a feeling of entitlement. Oh, my gosh. It's probably the worst. It's probably worse in education than it is anywhere else, although second in line would be federal government. It would be helpful to get this passed. It would be good to see a majority of Republicans, especially the conservatives, really rally around it. And I agree with your first point. I think it helps them in their midterm election because it puts the liberals on the defensive of having to say, hey, we're having to defend. Well, why shouldn't we fire this guy? He's leaking things. They're breaking laws, not only that,
I think the left wouldn't necessarily be on the defensive because I think that they would say, I'm going to embrace this. We don't want taxpayer money wasted. We're all about, you know, big government programs, but we don't want waste.
Yeah, that's their thing. They're going to jump on board. They're going to, in a sense, jump on the Trump train and say, listen, we don't believe that these folks who have been up to no good have gotten themselves into a deserving position of continuing to suck off the taxpayer on an annual basis. So, you know, this really speaks to the power of the bureaucracy and to the administrative courts and how this all gets tied up. I don't understand why this has not been passed yet. This makes perfectly good efficiency and in sense in how to run a business. And Trump obviously bringing his way of doing business to Washington, D.C., should be all over this and trying to push this. Obviously, there's other priorities, but it should be a big priority of Congress to get this through and to make sure that, listen, if you're going to work for the government, then you are not entitled to this job. You can be dismissed at will. You can be walked out of the building for doing something stupid and getting...
I do think that the wind is at the backs of Republicans to try to get the Merit Act. Let me say it again for our listeners. The Modern Employment Reform and Transformation Act. It's H.R. House of Representatives Bill 559, which makes it easier to fire federal employees who otherwise think that they're tenured. I think the wind is at Republicans' backs now. Why? Because of Donald Trump, in large measure. You're fired. You're fired. You're gone. And these are people he's brought in. Rex Tillerson. Well, this was a hard sell at first. He brought him in. He was all about Rex Tillerson. Then you're gone.
Well, he's changing the culture of Washington.
He sure is.
And one of the things that sticks out is that no one should feel that their job is safe. And if he continues to fire these high-level officials, cabinet folks, head of department agencies, everybody should be put on notice that, listen, if you're going to serve in government, you got to do this right and you got to be efficient and you got to get things done. And there's got to be some real action if we're going to move this administration
forward. And if you're dead wood, you're gone.
And no more is there. Right. You know, for the longest time, people think, well, there's institutional knowledge in these folks because they know all there is to know about this agency. And
they know
and
the web, the web of Washington.
But that doesn't count anymore in Washington, D.C. Trump has said, listen, I don't care how much you know, you're not going to be in service to the American people if you continue to do things that are inefficient and not getting action done.
Yeah, you got to be effective. Okay, Brian, back to you. An employee under this, just to be clear as to how this is supposed to work if it gets passed, is given a letter that he's a target for termination. And that letter can come after about 7 days. Let's say I'm the boss and I say, I don't like that Brian. He's really a slacker, or he misbehaves, or he does naughty things with other employees, or he steals, or whatever it is. So I, in my mind, start to write it up. Now, within 7 to 21 days, I have. Once you're a target for termination, I have to present this letter to you within 7 to 21 days. It behooves the employer sooner than later, but you have about 21 days, and that has to be documented. Then you can appeal, and then after the appeal, it is the Merit Systems Protection Board that decides within another 30 days. So all told, it could be about 60 days by the time you're a target to the time you are out of there if they rule in my favor as the employer. All right. What can go wrong with that? How do you see that?
Well, one, that is, in my mind, a long time for trouble to be stirred up. If you're talking about a couple of month period there and someone is, let's use the example, breaking the law or stealing, or they're sexually harassing someone. That's a code word today, right? Well, so you're going to let that go on for 60 days before you actually move on it?
No, the employer, I would say, okay, Brian, I know, I bring you in and I say, I know, I've got evidence, you're a sexual harasser. And here's my documentation, and you're on record now. Here's a letter that you're now a target for termination. You see, then it becomes the process of the appeal, and you might get a whole bunch of other documentation. And then it goes to this merit board, the Merit Systems Protection Board, that has 30 days. So I guess what they're trying to do in this is say, all told, soup to nuts, it's about 60 days. Okay. Do you think that's fair? Do you think that seems reasonable?
Absolutely. Because how many other people are walked out within a day's notice at a private sector job if your boss doesn't think?
So you would say it's even a little bit long.
It's more than gracious.
Listen, if you're engaging in a criminal act of some kind or something that blatantly violates policy, you should be walked out of the building
immediately.
Period. Like if you're on the internet.
Well, I suppose if I give it to Brian tomorrow, he comes into work and he's not going to be harassing the beautiful women that also work under me. He's just not because he's been on notice. So from that point on, he's going to be a good boy, right? I mean,
he should be. I mean, you would expect him to come in compliance with policy. But
if you were to rewrite the legislation, then how would you write it? Because these are kind of the quasi terms as they're ill-defined. Remember, it's got to go through the House and the Senate.
There are some things that are just so egregious that if you get caught doing it on government taxpayer time, you should be walked out of the building. No notice whatsoever.
Well, what about the appeal? What about I didn't do it? What about you got your facts wrong, boss? Sorry. Wait a minute. What about?
You have 30 seconds from your desk to the door to explain to your boss why you didn't do it.
It's called the elevator speech in 30 seconds. Oh. I'm more lenient than you guys are. I think this isn't bad. Soup to nuts, 60 days, it's not bad. I mean, it's not bad. Maybe it could be 45. Anyway, be on the lookout, folks. It's the Merit Act legislation, the Modern Employment Reform and Transformation Act. Employment Transformation. I love that. H.R. 559. I say Republicans should jump on this one. It would be a legislative win for them, and it would help win over votes in the midterms, which are right around the corner, it seems. All right, quick break. I'm Terry Gilbert. You're listening to Think America, Reason First, Then Converse. Find us at thinkamericaradio.com.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
There were many celebrities behind the anti-gun march, and many high school and college-age students say that, no, in retrospect, they didn't know all the threads of the gun issue, but they do think that they know the solution. And when asked, well, what's the solution? They say, well, we blame the NRA. All right. That's kind of a blanket statement, I think. They also blame their parents for not understanding democracy in the digital age. Remember that one that came out? Mom and dad, you just don't get it. And of course, they blame the police for being late. All of which is something based on what Nicholas Cruz did all by himself in Florida at a Florida high school. So what the students didn't, however, blame were school authorities for insisting on schools being gun-free zones. So it was very interesting when I saw the after talk about what happened in Florida. Some of the students said they joined the march for our lives, it's called, because their favorite celebrity was going to be there, and they believed in the celebrity's view of things. So let's get this straight, Brian. All right. if you're a 17-year-old kid, and let's say you're kind of shy, but all the rest of the kids say anti-guns, and some of your friends got slaughtered at a high school mass gun shooting, and you know that some of the celebrities like Paul Simon or Paul McCartney or Reese Witherspoon and others, they're all there going, marching along, and so you say, I'm going to join. What do you think about that, just for starters? Let's just kind of debrief that.
You know, isn't that natural? I mean, I was, no one believes it in this room, but at one point I was a high school senior at age 17, and way back in those days, had there been a march, and, you know, one of Charlie's Angels was going to be at the march, I would have probably shown up at the march no matter what we're marching for. It really wouldn't have mattered. So I can see the kids being taken in by their celebrities. Hey, so-and-so is going to be there, or this big
David Cassidy.
Yeah. I mean, these people are, you know, because now, especially with social media, these people are larger than life. They would have been larger than life when I was 17. I remember being in a speech or debate team when I was in high school. And one of the topics was nuclear power, not as opposed to just nuclear war. And so I kind of remember thinking to myself, well, I don't really know much about that. So what we did on that impromptu was I had to end up talking about, well, we're all probably going to get it with a nuclear weapon. So we went down this whole other road. I didn't believe a word of it. But instead of talking about things like, well, you know, if you use nuclear energy and, you know, you have all these power plants, you cut down on this. So there's a lot of times kids get sucked into things they have no idea about. And that's not to fault the kids. That's what makes you 17 and kind of clueless. Mm-hmm. But I think it's the... I think it's the consistent use of these kids, as the communists have always referred to all these people as useful idiots, because I think they had a better grasp on what these kids really are. They're really being used as useful idiots. In other words, they're just there for, you know, the teary drops, and, you know, everybody's very upset and we're being threatened, and nobody gets down into the nitty gritty of, well,
and so
you gotta
so,
have gun protection.
All right. So they're gonna follow a celeb. All right, we get that. What about this idea of parents not knowing democracy in the digital age? I mean, what kind of a statement is that with regard to the anti-gun? But that was a big one. Mom and dad don't know democracy in the digital age.
That's another.
What David Hogg kept screaming with profanities.
It's a lame excuse. Look, we know that just about every teenager out there is on some smart device looking and communicating when not interacting socially with other people. And so, you know, they're going to blame that, mom and dad not being on social media, and they're going to blame the NRA. Look, without sounding insensitive about what happened in the shooting, this is nothing more than a combination of celebrity worship and keeping your brand relevant. And when you have these pop stars out there that are trying to keep their name in the news and get on the cover of every magazine and news report, and you've got a following of kids who completely lose sight of what actually happened. Well, maybe not completely, but they just become enamored with these people up on stage talking about these issues, and they think this is the greatest thing. Sadly, it looks like it's turned more into a fad than anything else. And I'm not trying to be insensitive, but these kids, like Brian has said, a lot of times they haven't taken a deep dive into these issues. They don't understand.
I don't expect them to at 16 and 17.
And when you have a celebrity get up there and decide, well, the object here is to create a boogeyman and get everybody on board to go against the boogeyman, in this case, it's the NRA, then they are manipulating these kids like the Pied Piper and dragging them down their political agenda. And these kids who obviously
all
have
right. had Let me this... segue from that. Okay, so there's the boogeyman, the NRA. But part and parcel with talking about the NRA is obviously the issue of, do people kill people or do guns kill people? That's the core of so many of these mass shootings. So it's amazing to me. I'm mystified why some of these teenagers did not even try to address gun-free zones. It's mandatory that they go to school. It's obligatory.
Mm-hmm.
And they go every day to a place that isn't secure. That's like going every day to the airport that isn't secure.
It should be demanding more SROs.
Right. They should be demanding that it's secure. And how do you secure it? With guns, mostly. People who are trained with guns. It's amazing to me that didn't come up amid all these kids that are in the march. Final thought on that, Brian?
Well, because they're not being told the value of guns. So they just see them as something evil. They don't see them as a protector of freedom or your life. That's not what they see.
And now they go back to gun-free zones now that the march is over. And it's obligatory that they're there. And it hasn't come out in the dialogue, in the discourse, since that shooting. It's incredible to me.
And it will repeat itself over and over.
I pray not. Quick break. I'm Terry Gilbert. This is Think America. Reason first, then converse.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
I want to turn our attention now to an interview that I'm excited to have. We have Daniel Wagner with us. He is the author of a really, really detailed book about virtual terror, 21st century cyber warfare. And I booked him because I want to get into this whole Facebook stuff and how the internet has spread what he says terrorism, how it affects everybody and what we can do about it. He is the CEO of Country Risk Solutions. He deals with risk management and current affairs as an author and comes out of the University of Chicago's International Relations. All right, Daniel, welcome to the show. Nice to have you on Think America. Let's get right to it.
Good to be with you, Terry.
All right. So I've got your book. Thank you for sending it to me. Let's start first with the Facebook stuff, because I think this is hitting America in a way. Maybe we're all naive, but the idea that even on our instant messaging, Facebook can take and scan all of our messages. If I instant message you through Facebook on my cell phone, they know about that. I think America is coming around to saying, well, we've kind of heard that they snoop, or anybody who's behind the curtain, like the Wizard of Oz, they can get an idea of what we do. But this idea of knowing everything, our privacy is completely gone, right?
Yeah, that's pretty much true. And in large part, especially with social media, it is due to something called the third-party doctrine. And this means that everything that we do with social media and generally in digital media, et cetera, is, if it is not already public, it will be public. And most people, when they're sending messages, emails, college-age kids that are sexting and doing all this stuff, they don't realize that at some point in time, all of this stuff may be public and it may come back to haunt them later on in life.
All right. But, so what is your take then, since Zuckerberg and all the Facebook hierarchy is in the news and they may have to testify in front of Congress and the stock has dropped and all that? What is the upshot of where Zuckerberg is with all, because of Cambridge Analytica and what's come out? And we don't have time to go into that whole backstory. I think most of my audience knows that. What is the future for Zuckerberg facing Congress and the FTC and possibly, criminal action? How do you see it?
I think at this point they're going to want a scapegoat. Whether he ends up being it is debatable. To me, the larger issue is something that's been going on for a long time, and that is that the lobbyists have been working overtime in Washington on behalf of software and other firms to basically say, I don't want the liability. Put it on someone else. And I think when all the dust is settled with this Facebook episode, we will see that this is the core of the issue. Now, the question becomes, how can this liability issue be resolved? Because it points to a bigger issue, which is that the law, more generally, is very far behind the curve from where it needs to be in terms of attributing guilt, attributing responsibility, and actually, determining who is going to bear responsibility for all of this stuff.
Well, right, but lawmakers move at the pace they move at, and so here we kind of wait for the law and who is the responsible party and blah, 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 and then you got things like Facebook, or you've got, and this isn't the first time through the Obama administration, when President Obama is Obama Biden 2012, they did it then too, or Snapchat or any of this stuff. What can we do about it? I mean, we can try to goose our lawmakers to get hip and understand it. But this is computer science. It's difficult stuff. They're not going to understand it until they understand it. And you're right, they're behind the eight ball. What do we do about that?
So what we really need to do is we need to change our frame of reference from all of this stuff to being reactive, to being proactive. So if we remain reactive and simply dodge every time there's another bullet coming our way, rather than saying, hey, I'm adopting a more protective stance, and I'm going to expect that something like this is coming my way, and I'm going to know in advance what to do about it. That means that on an individual, business, and governmental level, we need to change the way we think about cyber risk more generally. It is not someone else's problem half a world away. Mm-hmm. It's on everyone's doorstep, and whether you realize it or not, every adult in this country has already been hacked, whether it was the result of Equifax or Target or the Office of Personnel Management a couple of years ago. Everyone has been hacked already. That being the case, you should presume that you need to have a much more proactive stance towards basic things like password protection and updating your software, et cetera. It really needs to be done on a regular basis.
Well, how regular is regular? Because all the average person hears is change your password every 6 weeks, 2 months. Some people don't do it until 6 months.
I speak to a lot of groups around the country, business groups and otherwise, and I always ask them, how often do you change your passwords, et cetera? You know, most of them say once every 6 months or once a year, which is just wholly inadequate. What I do, I don't mind telling you, is every time I turn on my computer, I update my software. And guess what? Whether that's 5 or 6 times a day, 5 or 6 times a day, there is new stuff to download, which means that the McAfees and the Nortons of the world, they're on top of this stuff. And if we take advantage of what it is that they're doing, we can do some very basic things that doesn't cost anything and takes very little time to start protecting ourselves.
Good advice. Now let's move on to the title of your book, Virtual Terrorism. That really is kind of a scary when it says terrorism. How do we go from just, you know, okay, I've been hacked and I got to set up a new Facebook account because somebody hacked in or they got my email, but now I'll just set up a new email account. How do we go from that to some of the scarier stuff you cover in your book having to do with terrorism?
Well, the reason that I called it virtual terror is you'll see at the beginning, I actually created a new definition for what terrorism is in the cyber era. It's no longer someone simply, you know, blowing up a car and getting on the headlines and, you know, making some waves for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's all about snooping, stealing, industrial espionage, cyber warfare, which is now gone into space, the military, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole new ballgame. So I have prescriptions in the book which talk in detail about what people can do at an individual, business, and government level. Let's start from the government and work our way down. The Office of Personnel Management went from being a basket case, being very famous for this breach a couple of years ago, to now being the gold standard of what government agencies need to do. And government agencies go to them to find out what they should be doing. At the business level, most businesses will spend, say, 3 or 4% of their revenue if they're switched on to try and protect themselves. They probably need to spend double or perhaps even triple that. Now, very few businesses are going to do that. But it starts with the tone at the top. If you're teaching your employees, you're going through educational programs, you're cyber resilient, you have good cyber hygiene, you're spending time, effort, and money on a regular basis, then you're probably going to be okay. Individual level, the same story goes. We need to make sure that we're doing things like taking advantage of anonymizing our own our own network at home. There are ways to scramble that. You can use virtual private networks to make yourself invisible on the internet, et cetera. Very, very basic things that are out there that people can do if they would just start paying attention to it.
All right. We're down to about 2 minutes, and I do want your take about all the Russian hacking. What are your comments about that? And I know that's a big subject, but we know that they were there to engage however they could in a nefarious way, hacking into the DNC, probably thinking Hillary would be the president, and then Donald Trump became the president. Now it's Russia, Russia, Russia. They continue to do this, especially with elections. Any comments as we come into the midterms, Daniel?
Well, first of all, I would say that so many governments around the world that have the capability to do something very similar to what the Russians are alleged to have done. And countries like Iran and North Korea can punch well above their weight because they're very talented in this area. My own take on Russia is that they're probably guilty, and it's never going to be proven that they're guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Because these actors, they operate in an anonymous, borderless, lawless world on the dark web, which can largely not be seen. And even if the guilty parties were identified, they will probably never be apprehended or prosecuted because We don't have the ability to do that right now.
Mm-hmm. What I'd like to do is bring you back for another, if you want to come back, and we can talk about artificial intelligence. I went to a seminar on this, and I was shocked when the speaker said, listen, computers are talking to each other. They're teaching each other stuff, and they're going to really outlive us if we don't kind of put the El Kabong on some of these computers and robots, because we're going to be in a robotic world. And it was just very frightening. He said, within the next 10 years. What's your take on that? Robots taking over in 10 years? Really?
Well, I'm actually in the middle of writing a book on AI, which should be out in the fall. So first of all, I'd be happy to come back and speak with you about it.
Thank you. Great.
But, you know, it really depends, Terry, on what you're talking about when you're talking about AI taking over in 10 years. The pace of change in terms of how AI is being integrated into military and government and a bunch of other stuff that's going on is so breathtaking that in some respects it is not hard to imagine that in 10 years a lot of the things that were fantasy to us in the movies, iRobot, etc., will become partial reality. I don't think that's too far-fetched at all.
It makes me scared, so let's talk about that. It always calms my nerves when we can talk about it. I'll book you on another edition of the program. For now, Daniel Wagner is the author of Virtual Terror, 21st Century Cyber Warfare. I assume they can pick it up at Amazon.
That's exactly right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Daniel. We'll have you back. Quick break. This is Think America, Reason First, Then Converse.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
All right. I really like talking to Daniel Wagner. Again, you can find his book on Amazon, Virtual Terror. It's a little scary, though. I will say that. Get it anyway. What'd you think, Brian?
Well, it'll be interesting to see if there is a price to pay for what Facebook has done, as he mentioned in there that, you know, he thought they were going to be the scapegoat. I'm anxious to see when Zuckerberg's up in front of Congress if it really matters.
Notice how the bad guy was for a couple of days, Cambridge Analytica, and then when they said, wait a minute, the Obama team did this 4 years prior to us doing it, and Facebook let them in the door, so now it's the onus is on Facebook.
Yeah, I think any good parent who teaches their kids basic hygiene should also include in that regimen cyber hygiene, as he pointed out.
Yes, that was a good term. Let's move to Megan. Megan does a cameo on the program. Everybody knows Megan. Megan the millennial. Let's talk to her about cavity police. The cavity police. Who are the cavity police? Well, almost all states have laws that dictate certain professional groups have to report any case that they see something, say something, of suspected child abuse and neglect. And so we got physicians, we got teachers, we got social workers, and now it appears we have dentists. There was a mother that shared a letter on Facebook, speaking of Facebook, from a dental office called Smiles for Keeps. This is out in Pennsylvania, Megan. In it informed her, she shared this letter, this particular letter that she got, that if she did not make a dental appointment for regular professional cleanings for her kid, she could be charged with dental neglect. And it was a law that was cited, the Pennsylvania Act 31. I'm not familiar with it that well, but it was on child abuse recognition and reporting, and the dental office threatened to report the mom to state authorities. So it sounds to me a little bit as if the dental office, Megan, is trying to get the annual checkup so they can bill insurance and so on and keep, you know, the doors open. But there is something to be said that if that kid opens his mouth and he sees cracked teeth, the dentist sees cracked teeth or, you know, a bruised upper lip or something, then you got to report it, right?
Right. And actually, Pennsylvania has mandated that healthcare professionals are supposed to report these things. They're called mandated reporters.
Right.
Or mandatory reporters. And so they are required to do so. However, I think this is taking it a little farther than that, Terry. If you read the letter, you'll notice that it didn't say anything about possibly just notifying us that you are taking your child to another dentist. It was, you need to bring your child in to see us or we will be reporting you. I think that's really, really dangerous language. The dentist later said, yeah, I believe that this is the right thing to do. I'm a mandatory reporter. And when I see a child, he elaborated, he says, I see a ton of children with dental neglect. And you wouldn't believe the impact that dental neglect has on a child's overall health and so on and so forth. And I think we have a couple of issues here. One is, I think we have overly zealous mandatory reporters. Clearly, he is also utilizing this as a way to ensure that patients come to see him, which is really kind of sick and twisted. But also, when we look at the way that some of the language is defined, basically, especially in Pennsylvania, child abuse is defined as an individual acting or failing to prevent something that causes serious harm to a child under the age of 18. The harm can take many forms. It can be physical injury, mental injury, of course, sexual abuse or exploitation. So when you look at the requirements here, or rather the language, it's very, very broad and very nebulous. Now, these mandatory reporters are required to do classes, to take classes, and they have to re-up every time they have to recertify their license. So I think that they are getting some guidance from the state and from lawmakers on how to interpret these things. Mm. But again, what we're doing, Terry, is we're turning untrained. I mean, we can say in essence that this person has undergone, I believe it's 3 hours in Pennsylvania of training on what neglect looks like, but we have people who are untrained who are reporting these instances of abuse, and they are in a very unique position of, as far as power is concerned. They're the healthcare professional, which gives them the advantage of being the expert in the field. And then additionally, they have the power of the law behind them. In Pennsylvania, almost 75% of the reports to their child protective services come from these mandatory reporters. Mm-hmm. So, I wonder how many of those things actually vet out. But think about it. If you are a mandatory reporter and the law says you have to report this, again, this dentist has taken it clearly too far. But if you are told that you are supposed to mandatorily report, then you're going to constantly cover yourself and you're going to report everything.
Well, of course you are. And you will find abuse. You say you the dentist. But in my experience, and I don't live in Pennsylvania, never have, I've been through there. But in my experience going to dentists with my own teeth or my kids' teeth or even driving a nephew to the dentist, it's always the front office. They push the appointments. And once you're there, right. It's like, well, you got to come back in 6 weeks. Six months. We'll see you there for your annual checkup and cleaning. They assume you are a patient. And so they push right. it. It's really the front office. And I think, that's coming from the dentist to say, get that patient back in so I can keep my doors open and, keep money in my pocket. Hold on to that thought there, Megan, and we'll be back to hear what Terry's talkers have to say here on Think America. We have Sean and Brian. They're chomping at the bit with their own teeth, chomp, chomp, to comment on this one. It's Think America. Reason first, then converse. ThinkAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
I've always been impressed when a dentist says, I can tell your health by looking at your mouth, Brian. They can tell infection, they can tell. And I always kind of go, really? I mean, wow, you must be wonder doctor to be able to do that. But I've heard that many, many times. I've heard that growing up, let's look at your mouth and they check the gums and so forth. So I would think under this, a kid, you open the mouth and if the kid has, broken teeth or sometimes teeth that, are just falling out of his mouth because he never had any hygiene I would imagine that the dentist can see all kinds of abuse and neglect, right?
Yeah, I'm sure they do. And I have
as well as health.
Yeah,
health
and
of the
I think good health begins in your mouth. That's absolutely true. I've heard dentists say it.
I never quite understood it, but I'll go with
because
it.
Because I know if there's if you don't take care of a cavity and there's a raging infection,
sure,
you are going
sure.
to have, that's so close to the brain. They've even linked some of those types of things
really?
To Alzheimer's. So I've heard that reported mm-hmm. as well. This to me, I get and understand that I want professionals to be able to report things that are the obvious. This just scares me a little bit that your dentist in looking for his 6 month renewal, kind of like your auto insurance renewal, mm-hmm. is going to turn you in because your kid's not brushing his teeth so well or you missed an appointment. I get those reminders on my phone as well to bring my sons in for appointments. And I don't want to be up in front of the board having to defend myself because I skipped an appointment and they're not happy because they're not getting that annual business back.
Right.
That's
right.
What concerns me.
So any state that passes laws that require this should make it a may instead of a shall. In other words, that you may report it instead of you shall report it, because now they're putting healthcare professional in a difficult position to do this. And
well,
so,
wouldn't that be the case with psychiatrists or teachers,
absolutely.
Social workers,
and it's
other physicians? Why not?
Yeah,
why wouldn't the dentist be included if they're doing it with everybody else?
And that's the thing. I get upset when I hear these stories of your children are asked, or you go to the doctor and in your new patient questionnaire, they ask, do you have any
firearms in the house. It's none of their business whether I have firearms in the house, but they want to know because maybe they're going to, you know, use that information at some point in time. It's none of their business. But at the same time, I see the other side of this when you have a family of like 17 kids who have never gone out of the house because their parents are wacky and they don't.
As in California?
As in California.
Yeah. Came from Fort Worth, Texas.
And you then, see a sign of some kid's teeth rotting out of his mouth because of the abuse. So, yeah, and I see a positive there. But again, it shouldn't be like crazy mandatory putting all the pressure. And there should be no profit motive there for the dentist to say, listen, if you don't come back to me, then I'm going to report you.
Sounds
profit-driven. Well, I think the dentists really try to get that repeat business. At least they know, let's talk in 6 months and see how you're doing if you got a healthy mouth. All right. Thanks so much. Megan, back to you. What do you got in the Change Your Life Technology segment as we close up the show?
Well, you know, there's that old axiom, Terry, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And when it comes to cybersecurity, apparently that is the approach that we're taking. You know that there's a ton of hacking going on with all of our technology.
We
utilize it in every capacity. So
we just talked about it in our interview. Yes, exactly.
Right, exactly. It's everywhere. And so it gives hackers even more opportunity to come in and get crucial confidential information. Even as important as technology is, it's kind of semi-fragile and subject to this hacking. So enter DARPA. DARPA is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which is out of the Department of Defense, and they've created yet another acronym, which is HACM, which is High Assurance Cyber Military Systems. Now, the goal of this program is directly to address hacking, and what they're doing is very, very different than what they've done in the past. What they've done in the past is they've tried to address any of the vulnerabilities that were discovered after they were discovered. So they see a hack, they see a hole, they patch it up, and they try to kind of replicate that across the system. Now what they're doing is they're utilizing new technology. They're using algorithms and artificial intelligence to try to actually address it before it happens. These mathematical analyses actually try to approach building a secure software right from the start. So it's anticipating, okay, well, could this be a place that a hacker enters? Could this be a place that a hacker enters? And it actually cleans it up. One of the tests that they did recently included a 6-week time frame. So they did it for 6 weeks. They tried to hack the system, but every single effort failed. So it looks like DARPA may be onto something, and I'm looking forward to something like this. I know that blockchain as well is looking to remedy some of the hacking issues, but this is what I see kind of coming out of technology, and I'm actually surprised that the U.S. government is being proactive on this one.
I think that part is good. I wonder if we can always keep up, though, because the minute we sort of get it under control, then somebody's smarter than the last guy. The nefarious creatures surface. Good info, Megan. Thank you so much. And thanks for weighing in on the cavity police as well. I find that a very fascinating topic. All right, that's it for this edition of Think America. Sean, thanks for being on the program, our kayak teacher and canoe teacher. I want to go down the rapids with you. I think that'd be fun. And Brian, for-profit education expert, thank you for being on the program. I'm Terry Gilbert. You can always find us at thinkamericaradio.com. This is Think America, where we reason first.
And then converse.
They got it. See you next time.
Welcome to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
Should we just eliminate the words human races? You know, there's the black race, the Caucasian race. Should we just eliminate all of that and maybe just say human race, singular? We'll talk about that on the program today. There's a social scientist that says that's what we need to do. Also, I'm very interested to get into an interview regarding Silicon Valley startups. You might have heard about a company named Theranos and its founder, Elizabeth Holmes. She was the total package for a while, but then the investigators came around to her startup and started accusing her of fraud. $9 billion startup. Now, well, not so much anymore. And we'll talk about lethal weapons versus non-lethal weapons. There is, in fact, a non-lethal weapon program with the DOD, and it is designed to save lives. You might be surprised to learn of this program since you may associate the DOD with lethal weapons and only lethal weapons. But we'll talk about non-lethal weapons and how they can play a critical role in filling the gaps for peace. Hello there, Terry here on Think America. This is Reason First, Then Converse. That's our motto of intelligent talk, where I bring in real people, real Americans into the studio. Of course, they're real people. They're non-broadcasters, though. They're everyday Americans to chew on topics, thought-provoking conversation starter topics where there's no wrong answer. Today, we have Brian. He is a for-profit education expert. Hello, Brian.
How are you, Terry?
Nice to have you on the program. Nice. Anxious for your thoughts and comments with regard to the topics. And we have Sean. He's a canoe and kayak teacher. You're an outdoors guy, huh?
I am. I love to paddle.
I hope. Not me. No, I would love to have some lessons. Once upon a time, I did some white water rafting in Jackson Hole, and it was dangerous.
Oh, yeah.
And it bounced us around a lot, and my head collided with my nephew's hard head, and I got a real bump on my forehead.
You're very lucky.
And I wasn't in a helmet.
Oh, boy.
I wasn't in a helmet, and we're lucky we weren't thrown over. Yeah. Anyway, it was fun, but kind of nerve-wracking at the same time.
Yep.
All right, let's get to it, guys. Build the wall. And Mexico is going to pay for it. This is my first topic for you. That's, of course, the pitch that we heard ad nauseum during the campaign trail. But now Trump wants the Pentagon to pay for it. All right. Well, that's a switch. And why? Because the omnibus bill that was signed last week had lots and lots of funding for the military. He put military first in priority and then begrudgingly signed the sucker. But now if he can't get the wall built with Mexico paying for it, what's wrong with the military? Brian, take a stab at that one.
Well, I think it was a brilliant strategy that probably wasn't well thought out when he should have vetoed the bill originally. But now that it is law, it is brilliant, and he's right to use it the way he's thinking. For him to go in and then redirect Congress to use those federal funds for building that wall and for how he is now going to have Mexico pay for it, probably in the renegotiation of NAFTA. You can use that as your bargaining chip so as to get, you know, if NAFTA gets renegotiated or if NAFTA gets ended, as the president has said on how many occasions has he said he wants a total renegotiation of it or he's getting out of it. If we get out of NAFTA, Mexico's economy is finished.
The idea that Mexico will pay for it, the payback or the paying for it, it can be defined in a lot of different ways, including the payback. We put the money up, or the military comes out of the military budget, and they call security the nation, and the DOD is involved, and maybe, you know, get some troops down there to kind of help, or, you know, the reservists or something. What do you think about that? I mean, he's going to get it done. I've seen blueprints of it.
Well, there's a whole lot of people that voted for President Trump because he said he was going to build a wall and he was going to make Mexico pay for it. And that is, in a sense, it's red meat that he threw to the American people to get elected. And so that's a promise that he made, and it's a promise that everybody would like him to keep. And I've even heard folks rumbling about how angry they are that he's kind of backed away from that. And now when you have had a military that has, under the Obama years, struggled to keep up to speed, to keep up with technology, and now you have this money that's supposed to go to the troops to help them get caught back up to speed with the Navy and the Air Force and the new technology, and now you hear that that money's going to be redirected under the definition of national security to the wall. You're probably running the risk of angering a lot of people that voted
for
you.
But there was many billions for the military. And when he says the military, it can come out of that, I think he's right.
I think it was $1.5 billion I heard, and the estimate was like they needed
70. Well,
there's been
so many figures bandied about, and it depends on what stretch of land you're talking about, and the land that can't have a wall there because nature doesn't allow for
it. The terrain.
Yeah. I think when he says build the wall through M, meaning military, I think through the omnibus bill, it was a bill like what Obama would proffer and sign or what under the Obama years. So we're printing a lot of money. All that money is, for the most part, going to the military because that's the top of the priority totem pole. Some of it can come through the military under DOD. I think it can get it done. And I think that in turn, based on NAFTA or other relationship trade deals that we're doing with Mexico, right now we've got to figure out the China trade deal issues with tariffs and so forth. But I think it can get done. And it might be the way that he ultimately designs it, and his supporters will say bravo.
That's left to be seen. And Brian, maybe you are right. Maybe Mexico will pay it back through the NAFTA negotiations.
I mean, it would sound logical. I mean, just imagine if they were to put a $10 tax on every wire money transfer from the U.S. to Mexico. How fast that could make up ground and help to pay for that wall, because that is the number one source of money to Mexico. The number one source of money is not oil reserves, which it probably should be.
Oh, no. It's the money that goes
it's
back.
It's money from America.
Right.
Moving into
from
Mexico.
From labor, from service industries, right. Going back into
back
Mexico.
Home.
But back to the whether or not promises made and kept and so forth. He cannot not produce this wall. He cannot.
He has to.
He has to.
He hung his hat on this.
He absolutely did.
It's the hill that he's going to die on for his election.
But and he's got the clock is ticking, because he's already said, I'm running it for a second term. I mean, before we know it, it's going to be the 4 years are going to be over, where the midterms are right around the corner already, if you can even believe it. He's got to start getting this erected, period.
Absolutely.
Period. I mean, he cannot not do this, right?
Absolutely. If he falls short on this, he's going to look like every other politician before him, including Congress, who failed to deliver on a promise of making
and
the
2 years
southern border
already
secure.
Over. I mean, yeah. Essentially, they're over. He's got two more. That means this thing has to start getting erected and down there on that southern border, or he doesn't have a second term.
He won't have a second term if he doesn't. So
don't you agree? I mean, it's now, right?
It's now or never. He has to deliver on it. You're right. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. And it doesn't, as a guy who voted for Trump, and when I would hear that even at the rallies, even on TV, I knew Mexico was not going to be sending Donald Trump a check or any president to pay for it.
And what most Americans don't understand is, why can't you just do a straight up or down vote on the wall, on the border security,
right,
and not get it all tied up with DACA, not get it all tied up with free trade, not get it all tied up with military expenditures? All of that stuff makes it more complicated, and you lose supporters. Just
well,
do a straight up
that,
and vote.
Straight
do you
up
want
and down
a wall
vote,
or not?
Just clean legislation. Let's say he does say this is national security, pure and simple. I mean, he's ready to put troops on the border because of the caravan. Yep. I mean, if that isn't national security-esque, you know, sounding like national security, looking like national security. You got an invasion of a caravan coming, although I heard this past week that they're not going to go right to the border because of what Trump said about putting the National Guard down there.
Yeah.
I mean, that was kind of threatening. So you've got all of the Central Americans that say, no, we're not going to move that close anyway. But nonetheless, it's national security. So an up and down vote on this, I mean, why not?
It makes complete sense. I mean, that's what all the American people.
And that's what all the argument is. This is national security.
Yeah, just vote. Vote already.
It's hard to get the Republican leadership, like guys like Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, to do that, though, because in all honesty, their hearts are not in that wall. They're just along for the ride because they happen to be speaker and they happen to be the majority leader, but they don't favor it. That's why you don't see a vote on it straight up or down.
And they're mired in all of the other political conversations, right, and policies that are, right, trying to get through, and they need to pick up a vote here and lose a vote there. And
well, then that cycles us back, then, if that's the case, and if you both believe that, to the omnibus bill and using it through the money that was,
absolutely,
set aside for the military. And we all know, let's just admit it, there's tons of waste in the military. Mm-hmm. We already know that, in
that's
spite of what
true.
Mad Dog Mattis said, you know, I'm going to spend your money wisely and all that. Oh, come on. I'm a military brat. I get that. There's tons and tons and tons of waste. But if it won't be an up and down vote and single legislation, hey, what is wrong with going through the M as in military?
Well, and that's the thing. If they do an up and down vote, then the folks back home can look at how their congressman voted. And if they didn't vote how they wanted, they can turn them out in a primary election and get somebody in there that will. And that seems to be what's happening with our political culture these days, is it's getting more conservative and more left. So if you're in California in one of those very liberal districts, then you're going to tend to vote for the guy that says absolutely no or hell no to the border wall. But if you're in a place like, who knows, Texas or Idaho, where it's very conservative, you're going to have a guy that votes yes. And if he doesn't vote yes, you're going to find somebody to replace him.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned California, because also this past week, if our listeners haven't been following, you've got two cities in California, and the latest one is Huntington Beach, that with a 6-1 vote to be anti-sanctuary city, this movement of anti-sanctuary, and to sue their own state, municipalities suing Sacramento for making it a sanctuary law, the wind is at their back not to be a sanctuary state or a sanctuary city and a sanctuary state. So this idea of you know, build the wall, and some of this is coming from Orange County, of course, but I was very intrigued with Huntington Beach, because that's not exactly Orange County per se, you know, where the heavy Republican red is. This is now, the pendulum is swinging the
You're
other
right.
direction.
Well, you know, polls in California show 54% of California voters, whether that's likely voters or where that number comes from, favor not being a sanctuary state. So Jerry Brown is governing against the majority of California.
And it's not only the wind is at their back, it's the federal dollars are at stake.
Indeed. And the other one, since I mentioned there were two, the second smallest city in Orange County, Los Alamitos, taking on the big Jerry Brown and all of the honchos in Sacramento.
San Diego's next.
All right, let's talk about human race versus human races. When we use those words, especially human races, is that racist? We'll try to sort it out when we return. ThinkAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
All right, before I read about a social scientist named Robert Wald Sussman, I didn't think much of using the term human races. You know, there's the black race, there's the Caucasian race, or the Negroed race, however you want to, Asian race, you know, however we refer to it. Certainly we got legal documents that refer this way, federal government documents and so forth. But he says that the prejudice and the hatred of racism is so embedded in our culture and has been so integral in our worldview that the concept of human races, plural, is in fact not a biological reality, but a cultural one. And if there's no such thing as races, plural, then there's no such thing as racism. All right, that's a heavy one. Let's start there, and then I'll ask you whether or not we think just using the term human race, singular, would be the better way to go.
I don't think using the word human race is negative or detrimental in any way. I think if you wanted to be correct scientifically, you would say we're Homo sapiens and go with that, because it keeps you out of trouble. You're using the Latin. But I guess if you use the Latin, then you're going back to the cultural side of things and you might offend somebody.
Homo sapien?
Homo sapien.
And that includes male and female.
Yes, yes.
And so why would that be offensive to use the Latin?
Well, in this day and age when we have...
When we're quick to offend or be offended.
Quick to offend about gender issues or sexual issues. It doesn't matter what you say. You're running the risk of offending somebody. And a lot of folk, myself included, are getting upset with the political correctness that tends to dominate this. Now, I understand human race as being, when you use the word race, you're talking about a family lineage that goes back in time, usually to a starting point. And if you go back in some of the older dictionaries before we modernized and became politically correct, that's exactly how human or how race was defined, tying it back to, through a lineage or descendant of folks from somebody who was scientifically called the stock.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at plants, we have different varieties of flowers or different varieties of berries or different varieties of squash. And so I'm trying to understand why he is so adamant about that because he's trying to tie it to culture.
He's tying it to culture, but he says that over the years, the concept of human races and all of the DNA and all of the, I mean, you mentioned plants and fruit, the cross-pollination of peoples over the years. Mm-hmm. It's not these races. It's really not a biological reality that we have all this because we've had all kinds of mixes throughout to create the DNA, unique DNA as relations, sexual relations have given us for generations.
The genetics.
Exactly. And so he says it's a cultural one, therefore we shouldn't refer to all these races. And if we didn't, we would eliminate a lot of preconceived prejudices. We just need to eliminate that from the vocab.
Well, I seem to think that he thinks that most of this was based on where people lived in regions around the planet, meaning that if you lived in a hotter area where you got more direct sunlight, that your melatonin skin color would be different. But that has been changing as we've moved into the future with the advancement of people being able to travel. And
well, he's saying everything changes constantly.
Yes.
Nothing is firm. Nothing is fixed. So by that definition, we should have just human race.
You know, Terry, it sounds like this guy, along with a lot of probably about 95% of the rest of academia, is looking for something to have a grievance against and who's digging.
Or at least have a study about.
Yeah. I mean, they're looking for a few more federal dollars to find out if hiding under your desk makes you a racist at this point. This is just preposterous beyond belief. There are differences between the races. Now, whether we call ourselves the human race or the human races, because there are differences, there are medical and biological differences between blacks and whites, if you would. A white, I've never known of a story or a case where someone who is a white Caucasian who had sickle cell anemia, right? We specifically, that is specifically within the black race. So there are differences, but I think it's clowns like this that kind of come out and drag all these things up and they make everything about race. So we can't even have an honest, good conversation about differences.
So it's a genetic.
But his aim is not to talk, the aim of all of this is not to get into science per se. The aim, and show compare and contrast, the aim is to change vocabulary so we don't have preconceived ideas of racism. How do we eliminate racism? Well, maybe we shouldn't say there's different races. That's what he's trying to get at. Now, whether or not he's successful is another story. But it's an interesting... He's a social scientist, Brian. He's not an anthropologist. He's not a psychiatrist. He's not a psychologist. He's a social scientist.
It doesn't sound like he's pro-diversity either.
Well, he just believes that prejudice and hatred is so embedded in our culture, and he's looking at how that can be pruned from the culture. And maybe if we keep having these categories of races, we then can have racism as a result. That's his theory. You can read more about it. Newsweek.com, there's no such thing as race. Straight ahead, let's talk about Silicon Valley when we return on Think America. Reason first, then converse.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
Really excited to get into this topic with Silicon Valley author and commentator on Silicon Valley startups, Ann Bridges. I have brought her to the air, and thanks in advance for doing the program, Ann, because I'm interested in the whole area of Silicon Valley and startups. In particular, what's been in the news lately is the company Theranos and its founder, Elizabeth Holmes. Now, a lot of people may not, across the United States, may not know too much about Silicon Valley or Elizabeth Holmes, but she was the it girl, very smart, great education at Stanford, got a lot of capital behind her for a company that she started called Theranos, but little by little, it was a blood diagnostics company that was once valued at $9 billion. But little by little by little, more journalists and investigators started looking at the company and started to wave the flag of fraud. Hello, Anne. Welcome to the program. Let's talk about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos and all Silicon Valley startups. Welcome to Think America.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. I know you know a little bit about Elizabeth Holmes. I understand you, too, went to Stanford, and you're quite the author. You talk about things in Silicon Valley. So how does a person that seemingly has all the cards, brains, beauty, very highly ambitious, extremely talented, then fall so far?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think the missing component there is that her product did not work. She had a vision for what could be. She was very ambitious, smart, one could say a tad headstrong. She actually dropped out of Stanford at age 19 and convinced her parents to take her extra couple years of tuition to start her idea for her blood testing company. And somewhere over the years, her idea did not pan out. And the problem is that she kept that information from her investors, from her board of directors, which was a list of people anyone would die to have associated with a startup. And somewhere along the line, she decided to cross that very critical line and start lying, and it became fraudulent, and the SEC just recently fined her and penalized her from being able to run a company again for at least 10 years.
Yes, and I understand there's a criminal investigation underway as well, correct?
Yes, that's correct, and rightfully so, because bottom line, she did purposely mislead investors, and that is a crime.
All right, let's get to that, because that's what really interests me. And I don't know the woman. I'm sad to see this, but I'm a little sensitive to when somebody has a startup idea. And in the world of barking about how great your startup is to investors, you need to bark. You need to really say, wow, let me tell you what's going on here, because that's what they want to hear. They're not going to plop money at you if you don't wow them. So I'm a little sensitive to what she had to do, I mean, to compete that way. And of course, you know, if you bark too loud and you don't have bite behind it and you don't deliver, of course the investigators are going to come in and they're going to shut you down. But at the beginning, talk to us about the beginning, because if you don't wow them, you're not even in the game, right?
Well, sure. I mean, anyone with a great idea that's looking for money to fund that idea has to present an exciting concept. And Silicon Valley is all about that. What's the breakthrough concept? What's brand new? And she was the perfect spokesman. She was blonde, young, passionate about her idea. She was perfect to be able to show to the rest of the world that Silicon Valley did indeed have promotable women. It was not a sexist environment. They were willing to invest in someone who could do it. The problem is that at some point along the line, once you accept that money and you put those dollars to work in research and development and coming up with a prototype product and actually going so far to talk to potential customers like Walgreens, who was planning on launching it nationally throughout their chain, and it's not working, you have to admit it. You have to do that confession to your board of directors, to your investors, and say, hey, I need more time. You have to be willing to admit failure. And that's where she crossed that line. You need to admit it when you cannot deliver.
Well, so you wouldn't say that she was unusual in the barking, the wow effect at the beginning, at 19. She must have wowed her parents to say, take my tuition and don't give it to Stanford, for crying out loud. Well, I mean, it's so competitive to get in. I'm surprised the parents went for it. So she must have wowed her parents to use that to start up. So, but I don't hear you say that she was unusual at the beginning, because as you said, if you're not there to wow that investor, you're not in the game. It came later, right? When she saw
correct
troubles with her startup.
Right. Right. Silicon Valley is full of that. In fact, there's a phrase here. It's called fake it until you make it, which is, you know, you do everything you can to show that you are successful, even though you're scrambling behind the scenes at 2 o'clock in the morning to deliver, you know, that demonstration product. But she was well beyond that. She took hundreds of millions of dollars of funding. She was the poster child for the first female running a billion-dollar valued company. She had employees, and at no point did she say, hey, this is not working anymore. She continued it, and that's where if you read the SEC filing, there's very specific points along the way where she would take the sample blood from, for example, one of the potential investors and go behind a closed door and come back and say, oh, we just ran all these tests on your blood. And what was going on behind that closed door was using other people's product. And that's a flat-out lie. So her patent, her idea, was not delivering what she was continuing to promise, and that was the problem.
All right. Now, do you think along the way, if somebody got to her and she had a coming-to-Jesus moment and said, I can't keep taking money when my startup just isn't working the way I had envisioned it, do you think she could have sort of remedied things, or if the initial idea doesn't work, she's out? Do you think she could have saved herself along the way?
You know, yes, I do. I think that, first of all, investors, professional investors, are aware that they're risking money, and most of them don't pan out. You don't hear about many of the failures. But a lot of the CEOs today have tried multiple companies, and the first few failed, and the second, you know, finally they got to one that worked. There is no problem with her saying, oh, you know, I was youthful, I was naive at 19 with my idea, but this is going to take 10 years to develop instead of 5. And then, you know, you either have investors who say, yeah, fine, we're going to give you less money or fire everyone except your, you know, your best scientists, and it's going to take longer. But I think she got herself onto this media blitz that made her a celebrity well before it was deserved. And maybe she had a hard time unwinding that. It certainly takes a lot of courage to admit failure, to admit that this did not work out the way she wanted to, and maybe she didn't have a confidant to guide her.
Mm-hmm.
But that's part of running a company. You need that kind of network of professionals surrounding you to give you that kind of guidance, and that's what a board of directors should be. That's what your president should be, and somewhere along the line, they all failed.
Well, and I think she believed her own hype, too, and then didn't want to look backwards, so that's where the deception started to come in. Just throw more money at it, and somewhere along the way, it'll still work.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So can she resurrect herself if she's not charged criminally?
Probably. She would probably, my advice to her would be to go back to school, get your degrees. She's sharp. She's ambitious. And people would be willing to forgive her if she came up with a great product. They may want to vet and have her prove that product a little bit more. She may have a lot more scrutiny next time. My guess is she's more likely to be successful writing books and selling her story over and over and over again. It's really up to her. She's young. She's got many, many years to decide how she wants to develop the rest of her life.
I was surprised that the SEC in the civil suit, which is what she's just gotten herself through, only slapped her, or they settled for only $500,000.
Yeah.
I was kind of surprised. That's not a lot of money for what they're claiming she was up to.
That's correct. But the SEC has limited powers, and so that's why the whole concept of the criminal investigation. There's also a civil suit being brought against the company and the president for more money, saying that they were misled.
Oh, wow. All right. We're down to about 30 seconds. And do you think she's going to be charged criminally, yes or no?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And what is she looking at? Multiple counts?
I would think she would have counts for at least each time that she lied, and to each person.
Oh, that's jail time. That's serious jail time. Finally, tell us about your latest book.
Well, my latest book that's the most timely is actually Rare Metal, which is about China and some of the posturing of what happens if products and goods that we rely on from China are embargoed due to a political dispute. eerily in the headlines today, and that is exactly the issue we're going back and forth on.
I smell a talk topic with you down the road, so we'll have you back. Thank you. Ann Bridges, a rare metal author and a commentator on Silicon Valley startups.
Thank you, Terry. You bet.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Think America. Reason first, then converse.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
Hi, Brian. Your thoughts on the interview?
Good interview. Really liked it. Very insightful. The fine line between what goes on up there in Silicon Valley is there's always a lot of talk. Hey, this is the next greatest thing. But it cannot be that your product is a fraud.
Yeah, but you know, you're a creator, you're an innovator, you're inventing something. How do you know when you're barking for the money whether it will turn out to be a fraudulent deal?
Yeah, I think Anne, or I'm sorry, Elizabeth had a bad case of Icarus syndrome, which flew, you know, the Greek god
the
that
Greek
flew
myth,
to.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
in mythology.
I think, you know, there's a technology infatuation out there, and I just think that she probably didn't have the business maturity and acumen and got just caught up in this what turned out to be a downward spiral.
I also think for type A personalities that are supposed to achieve, and Lord knows that's her entire life even to get into a school like Stanford, she's there saying, I can't look backwards. I've got to just continue on. And she's continuing on the myth of what this company could do because she can't fail. Her whole life probably wasn't about failure. That was an angle we didn't have time to bring up with Ann Bridges, but that would be, I think, part of it. All right, let's move on. The DOD, Department of Defense, has a non-lethal weapons program, guys, and it's designed to save lives. You might be surprised to learn about this. A lot of people associate Department of Defense with only lethal weapons. But according to the DOD, quote, non-lethal weapons can play a critical role in filling gaps between shouting and shooting options as part of the escalation of force. When I looked into this, Megan, I was pleasantly surprised to learn about it. I didn't know much about it. They're working on a directed energy weapon that tells the enemy to go away. So it doesn't have to kill the enemy. Technology creating sound waves with laser pulses. What do you think about this non-lethal weapons program?
Well, I mean, in theory, I really like it. I like the idea of the military employing non-lethal uses, especially in a combat situation. And in fact, the entire non-lethal weapons division was inspired by a story out of the Middle East where some soldiers were trying to notify a van that they couldn't proceed any further, but because of the language barriers, they kept going on the Iraqi checkpoint. And when the van failed to stop, then the soldiers ended up firing on the van and they killed 7 women and children. So what they're trying to figure out is, okay, well, how do we bridge that gap between shouting and then shooting at somebody, including killing a number of civilians? So I like the idea of them being able to employ non-lethal weapons in highly complex and concentrated urban areas. The only concern that I have about this is, again, if I'm standing there and I have a non-lethal weapon and a lethal weapon at my disposal, really the truth is I could utilize non-lethal weapon if I wanted to, and then utilize the lethal weapon to really make the killing easier. And that's one of the arguments against non-lethal weapons being used. But I do like the idea, in theory. I really, really do, because I think that this is the direction that we need to go in. Unfortunately, we see so many friendly fire and civilian casualties in any kind of warfare. So although it may not be a perfect solution, I do like the idea. I like the idea of the military saying, hey, there may be at least something in between us yelling at someone and then us killing someone or damaging property. So it makes me happy, actually, to be honest with you, Terry. And normally the stuff out of the Department of Defense doesn't make me happy. This is a rare moment.
Well, you know, many people that I talk to, they say, well, the purpose of the military is to kill the enemy. I think that's narrow. And I always come back with say, no, the purpose is to win the war. And there's ways to win the war. First of all, you got to be in the war and acknowledge that it is a war and try to do it as swiftly as possible. And if parts of the ways of doing that is to have a non-lethal weapon, why not use it, of course? I mean, right now, we're in all kinds of quote-unquote warfare, are we not? And what are we doing? We are engaging in putting a lot of money into our military so that we can walk softly but carry a big, big, big stick to the world so that we don't engage in actual combat. That's, you know, the military, through the strength of what we have, you don't dare take on the United States. Peace through strength used to be part of, you know, Strategic Air Command. And I think for those Strategic Air Command bases that are still there, that is still the mantra, where you see that big fist coming through the Iron Shield, peace through strength. So I like this very much. And if it's a way to win the war for the peace, of course, why not?
Right, definitely. And let's be honest, the true point of the military, the United States military, is to defend our country. So the way that we can do that, minimizing loss of life, the better.
Correct. All right, we'll hear what Terry's talkers, Sean and Brian, have to say when we return on this one. By the way, you can find the article in bigthink.com. You can find our show, thinkamericaradio.com. I'll be right back.
Welcome back to Think America with Terry Gilbert.
All right, non-lethal weapons program. Megan was interested in reading up on this, and so was I. I like this idea, but Brian, to you, why don't we hear about these positive things that the military is doing with a non-lethal weapons program? Why don't they promote it?
My feeling, I mean, I don't have inside knowledge to that, but my feeling would be that the Department of Defense doesn't want to give out a feeling that we're not somehow creating very lethal weapons. They don't want our enemies to somehow think we're getting soft. So I think this is good back channel stuff.
So that would be strategy.
Yeah,
that's
strategy. So as in other words, you know, it's always walk softly, carry a big stick. Even if half the size stick would actually do the job, right? You tell them you have a 14-foot stick, not the 7-foot. And I think that's probably it for that. I do like the fact that they're doing this, and anything that keeps military personnel safe and keeps them out of harm's way, I am all for. So no matter what form that takes, it's fine. If it's another tool for them to use, it's like a policeman with a taser. If that gets the job done and gets that, and if it gets that guy arrested that's going to do harm down the road and no policeman's hurt, I'm all for
rubber bullets.
Well, and the other thing is all of this has to do with technology. I mean, this is a non-lethal weapon. We know about guns. We know about bombs. We know. Right. But on stuff of this where they're directing energy in a different way so that the enemy goes away, that's all really high class and progressive technology. You're not going to want to promote that, are you? No, of course not. So we don't hear about it.
I would agree with you. I think that it's a matter of operational security. They don't want to reveal too much to potential threats, and that's one reason. I do think that over time with technology, we've been able to put more and more distance between the person that we're the enemy and ourselves, and to protect our troops, and we're seeing that through drones. This is another example of possibly robots, AI coming into play, where we no longer have to send an actual human being into battle. And so we're putting that distance for the sake of the security of that person. I see this as kind of an EMP, electronic magnetic pulse type of approach to things. And I don't know if we've read about that before. But in another way, to me, it's like PsychOps 2.0.
Mm.
You know, we're doing ways to try to deter the threat by big, scary booms and loud noises and burning this and making a lot of smoke.
How do you think, well, we got a few extra minutes on this topic since we kind of agree quickly, guys, how do you think we're doing, America, in telling the world we're back militaristically?
I think we're on the upswing.
Yeah.
I think we're getting back in the game.
You think it's working anyway?
I do. I think we're getting back in the game. And I think when you hear motions out of China about the South Pacific and they're getting concerned and worried, yeah, I think we're back.
Yeah, I do. And I think it also helps that Trump also announces it every other week. So that probably helps as well.
On Twitter.
Yeah. So they're seeing that our military prowess is king. All right. Change Your Life Technology, Megan. Let's wrap up the show.
Yeah, definitely, Terry. Well, I don't know if you knew this, but there's somewhere they estimate between 285 million people worldwide who are visually impaired, with 39 million of those individuals who are fully blind and the remaining who have low vision. So this is a really big issue around the world. And, of course, we've always, I think since medicine evolved, we've been trying to figure out a way to combat blindness and low vision. Well, there's some Chinese researchers out of the Fudan University and the University of Science and Technology of China. And what they're doing is they're actually using artificial photoreceptors to help produce an electric signal that's sent through the optic nerve straight to the brain. Now, of course, you know who they're conducting these tests on first, Terry? It's going to be the poor mice, right?
Always.
Always the poor mice.
Don't do it on Mickey Mouse, though.
And they use mice who have been genetically engineered to have degraded photoreceptors. And what they do is they replace those photoreceptors with artificial ones made from tiny little nanowires, which have been covered with gold nanoparticles. And the reason that they use this is because it has a high surface area, has large charge transport mobility, and it also has excellent biocompatibility and stability. And all that means is that it allows what is being seen by the photoreceptor to be transmitted easier back into the brain. I wouldn't say easily, but it's a little bit easier than maybe some of the other substances that they can use. Now, of course, they're testing it on mice right now. They've seen quite a substantial and promising results, but we probably have quite a bit of time before we're going to be seeing any of this use on humans. But I'm not sure. You know, I always think about this with artificial intelligence and the way AI is moving forward. You might see things like this faster.
All right. Yeah, well, you might. I talked to somebody at a lecture, and he says 10 years, it's all about AI. Anyway, it's kind of scary. Good report, Megan. Thank you very much. And I want to say thank you, of course, to our two talkers, Sean and Brian. Great having you both on the program. You can always find us at thinkamericaradio.com. Remember our moniker, Reason First.
And then converse.
We'll see you next time. I'm Terry Gilbert.